This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I'm joined, as always, by the Doctor of Style, the Nickster, Nick Duke.
God!
Nick, how are you, good sir?
I am doing very well, and I apologize for my preemptive screaming that people may have just heard. I thought we were having audio issues, but we're not! For now! It may happen at some point in the future, so, at least I didn't complete the expletive that time.
That's right. Well, quite frankly, folks, we have been dealing with some, severe, as you've noticed, technical difficulties in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I think it's been, Nick. And we cannot get to the bottom of what is causing these on either of our ends. So stay tuned, folks, as we attempt in coming weeks to fix them completely. But bear with us.
We are trying something right now. This episode is going to be something of an experiment. And if it works, then we'll perhaps have come to a solution. But that's all a bit technical. The important thing is that our podcast future is secure.
Is it, though?
I would have to think it's fairly secure, given that we are the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. So,
I think that's fairly secure.
That is a wonderful point. But before we get cracking on our off the page this week, I want to apologize to the listeners last week. We mentioned that we were going to do the rundown last week, but we didn't.
Nope.
We were having some issues with, I think you were sick at that time, having a little bit of the rundown issue yourself and, or the runs down, if you will.
Oh.
And
I wasn't quite sick yet, but I could feel it knocking upon my chamber door.
Knocking on your chamber door. I just plumb forgot. And then on top of that, there wasn't anything that interesting to talk about.
And we were exhausted, as we often are whenever we do this show.
As we often are. So I apologize for that. We will have a rundown this week.
Probably.
We got some stuff to talk about. And all of our other normal stuff that you can...
Yes! Speaking of things we forgot last week.
Yeah, the ticker that didn't work last week has suddenly come alive, Nick.
Yeah.
It's like it's been charged with the energy of the Eradicator.
Oh!
And here it comes. What do we got here? Let's see here. North Korea launches nuclear test. No, that's not it, no. Let's see here.
Fake news.
End of world coming soon.
American democracy in shambles.
Ah! Ho-Ho Loon, still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
Yes, and consequently still in the WrestleMania 33 program.
There you have it, folks. Breaking news right here. Only on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. As best we know, we are the only source for Ho-Ho Loon news on the internet. So
sadly, that's probably true. We are probably the only purveyor of weekly Ho-Ho Loon updates on all the interwebs. And there, folks, we're having the audio issues. We made it a few minutes, though, Greg. That's pretty good.
We made it 4 minutes longer than we did last week, I think.
That's absolutely right. So, anyway.
Nevertheless. So, on to Off the Page. And we've got a dandy for you this week, folks. That's right, a dandy. Normally, we focus on television shows or games of some kind and Off the Page, usually television shows and movies. But this time around, we have got
We've got a very special episode because for the first time ever, we're going to be reviewing a script. And why a script, you might ask? Well, it's a script. Because it's we're doing a script because it's for a movie that never wound up getting made. Right, Greg?
That's correct, Nick. What you just said is correct.
I said that we're reviewing a script because, you know, there is no actual movie because the movie itself never got made.
Oh, yes, that is indeed correct. The movie that we are reviewing, or the script, rather, that we are reviewing is the much – well, let me put it this way. One of the much ballyhooed scripts for Superman Lives. This, for those who don't know, was the never-made Tim Burton Superman movie of the 1990s that was going to come out in 1998 and was going to star Nicolas Cage as Superman with Tim Burton directing. And who wrote this script, you might ask? None other than Mr. Kevin Smith. This is a project that had a pretty controversial history and unique, one might say, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was Warner Brothers' attempt in the mid to late 90s to reboot. Not necessarily reboot, but get the Superman film franchise back on track. And, you know, it went through, like you said, a variety of script writers and went through quite the complicated development hell process before eventually being shelved altogether, you know, in, I want to say, 1998 or 1999, somewhere in that time.
Yes. Before becoming Superman Lives, the project had initially begun as Superman Reborn, and the initial script for that was actually written sometime around 94 or 95, and somehow it ended up in the hands of Kevin Smith, who was a comic book fan, as everybody knows, and he hated it, and he voiced to Warner Brothers how much he hated it. And At a certain point, they got so tired of him complaining about this that they said, hey, well, if you hate it so much, why don't you write one? And so he said, sure. And thus, Kevin Smith became the scriptwriter for what would be Superman's big return to the screen for the first time since the abomination that was Superman IV, The Quest for Peace.
Yeah, absolutely. You asked how he got involved. He got involved because he was asked to come take a meeting at Warner Brothers because they wanted to discuss various projects they were looking for writers for. He went into a meeting, and I know that they pitched him three different projects, you know, or brought up three different projects that needed writers. I don't remember what the three projects were, but I do know that one of them was Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, and that was an interesting led to Kevin kind of asking why in the world they were doing that, and the guy said something to the effect of, well, we're doing a lot of things we aren't really sure what to do with. Take Superman, for example. And then he kind of pushed the Superman angle until he was able to get a copy of the script and, as you said, read it and hated it.
Yes, and we haven't actually read that script, although it is floating around on the interweb, but nevertheless, he was eventually commissioned to write this new movie himself, and there were a few prerequisites to writing this movie. Now, Nick, you've actually watched the documentary, The Death of Superman Lives. What were some of the prerequisites before the script was ever even written that he went that Smith had to come into this project with?
Are you referring to the John Peters prerequisites?
Now, I don't know if those came after the first draft or not. I was leaving that to you because I haven't actually watched the documentary.
Okay, so based on my understanding of how this whole thing went down, he eventually wound up having a meeting with Lorenzo Di Bonaventura, who at the time was the head of Warner Brothers, and you know, De Bonaventura asked him to basically come back with a pitch. And so what Kevin did was he went out and wrote based on, you know, he kept some elements of the Superman Reborn idea. The studio was very keen on doing a big screen version of The Death of Superman. It had done, as you know, big business in the comics, and they wanted to capitalize on that for the film franchise. And so he went and wrote what wound up being a 40 to 50 page treatment. Because, as you know, Kevin Smith, he doesn't really write action or very well. He's a dialogue guy. So he brought back, you know, essentially a third of the script with just big chunks of dialogue, entire exchanges that were already written out, and showed it to Di Bonaventura, who liked it, and they set up the meeting for him to meet with the film's executive producer, one John Peters, who was also the producer of Batman back in 1989.
And I understand that Peters had certain things that he wanted to be a part of this project.
Yeah, so as the story goes, it's related in the documentary, and Kevin also related on one of his An Evening with Kevin Smith DVD kind of Q&A specials. Once he took the first draft of the script over to Peter's house, Peter's didn't want to read the script. He wanted Kevin to come over and read it to him. So as Kevin relates in the story, he goes to John Peter's house. John Peter's lies down on the couch and literally puts his hands in front of his face as if he is projecting a film screen onto the ceiling of his living room so that he can, quote, watch the movie as Kevin reads the script to him. So Kevin reads him this entire script, and, you know, at the end of it, he goes, you know, I like it, we're going to move forward with it, but there's three things I want you to do for the second draft. One, I don't want to see him in that suit. And Kevin says, what suit? The Superman suit? Yeah, no Superman suit. And I quote, too faggy. The second thing, I don't want to see him flying. It always looks fake to me. No flying. He's like, but he's Superman. He has to fly. No flying in the movie. And the third thing, he has to fight a giant spider in the third act. And you know why? Because the giant spider is, of course, the fiercest killer in the animal kingdom.
There you have it. And for those who find this unbelievable, if you've ever listened to or read an interview with John Peters, it suddenly becomes much more believable.
Yeah, you really should watch the documentary, or at the very least watch the Kevin Smith bit about it from his Q&A special. There are various other asides, like Peters telling Kevin Smith at one point, you know, you and I, we're going to do a great Superman. You know why? Because we both get Superman. Because me, you, and Superman, we're all from the streets. And various other things like that.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the lack of flying thing, because in this script, Superman flies a lot, doesn't he?
Yes. I don't know where that came from or why it, you know, didn't survive through the multiple script drafts. Now, granted, we read my understanding is that we read Kevin's final draft, the last draft that he wrote before being removed from the project.
This is the second revision, the third overall script.
Yes, from him. That is my understanding as well. So
for those that would like we were originally going to review the very first script, but the problem is it's really hard to find. All of the sites that used to host it have been taken down. Luckily, you can find this one, which is the third version, and this is dated March 27th, 1997. You can find this on the website scriptorama.com, script-o-rama.com, and it's interesting. One of the things that every version of Superman Lives has in common, and Superman Reborn had in common as well, is Warner Brothers wanted both Brainiac and Lex Luthor in this movie. They were hell-bent on it. That was going to happen regardless of who wrote it. So,
and with them wanting death of Superman, it would only stand to reason that Doomsday was going to be a major part as well.
Yes, they wanted Doomsday as well and the death of Superman, and they wanted Lex and Brainiac. So already you're trying to cram a lot of concepts into one movie, particularly since general audiences had never been exposed to Doomsday or to Brainiac or to Elrond, as we'll discuss in this, or to the Eradicator, as we'll discuss in this. So you're really introducing a lot of brand new concepts in one movie and cramming them all together. Stop me if you've heard that before with a Warner Brothers movie.
And it was 1996, 1997. You know, the multiple villain phenomenon was in full swing. What with Batman Returns having done the Bat, the Cat, and the Penguin. You had Batman Forever, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, which of course had both Riddler and Two-Face. And then of course, Batman and Robin was in the development process, which was going to have multiple villains as well. So it just kind of seemed to be that what they thought the superhero genre needed at the time.
Yes, certainly what one might consider to be somewhat of a unique situation.
Indeed.
Nevertheless, all of these things they wanted to have in the movie, and Smith overwhelm the viewing audience. So we've set kind of the backstory of this, and we've set kind of what the expectations were going in. The spider monster ends up becoming something called a Thanagarian snare beast, which was a pretty clever nod to the comics. Thanagar, of course, is the home of the hawk people in the comics, but evidently also the home of spider people. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting, you know, the Thanagarian snare beast label was basically worked up by Kevin as a way to come up with some kind of way to force the giant spider into the third act that Peters had requested. Apparently, the story on that is that one of the movies that Peters most vividly remembered seeing as a kid was the original King Kong. And that film, you know, had a giant spider fight in it. And he just always wanted a similar moment in a movie that he produced. And funnily enough, would wind up getting it in a film known as Wild Wild West, which most of you hopefully have not seen.
Yes. We're going straight to the Wild Wild West, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Was what people said about that film at the time. Anyhow, this script does a decent job of tying all these concepts together. The Thanagarian snare beast actually doesn't bother me at all in the script. The way that Smith worked it in makes sense. The only problem that I imagine when reading the script, Nick, is how on earth could they have made this look good in 1998?
It would have been tough, especially that Doomsday fight, you know, like... The way it is described, and then kind of the whole last third act with the Eradicator constantly, you know, shape shifting and whatnot, it would have taken a Terminator 2 like level of special effects to really pull it off, and Warner Brothers to that point had not really shown an ability to do that.
So let's run down this script real quick, Nick. Both of us have finished reading the script, of course,
mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting because we start the movie not with Superman and not with a, you know, what you might think of today as a pre-credits James Bond style sequence. We start with Brainiac, actually, and the introduction of Brainiac. And it's actually kind of creepy and kind of cool how it's described here in the script. Almost a little bit like Star Wars, actually. I got the implication that the slow-moving alien craft thing was very inspired by Star Wars, which makes sense if you know Kevin Smith's history. And almost like an alien vibe when it comes to Brainiac taking out these two alien pilots and absorbing their life force. What did you think of this opening scene where we're introduced to both Brainiac, who is seeking an energy source to power him and to permanently... constitute his body, and his interesting pet robot known as Elrond. What did you make of all this, Nick?
It was certainly a unique situation. I kind of liked the take on Brainiac pretty much from the jump. Elrond, to me, while I admittedly chuckled a few times during the script, even from the first appearance, it is one of the many things in the script that I think just dates it so much as being of its time. You know, like, this was the thing, the quirky sidekick that you had to have for comedic relief. It just has such a very mid to late 90s feel about it, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Think of a robotic Otis.
Yes, essentially. Is the gimmick, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Nick, you've read more of Elrond in the comics. He is not like this in the comics, is he?
No, Elrond is more of like... Hard to say. Yeah, you know what? Actually, it is kind of like this. He's not usually associated with Brainiac, but he is. Oh, what's the guy's name? The cheesy villain that DeMatteis and Giffen created. I want to say Manga Khan or something like that. But yeah, he was a little robotic sidekick flunky to them. The problem is, as much as I love Kevin, especially from this era, he doesn't write the character nearly as well as Giffen or DeMatteis do.
Yeah, and like you said, there are actually some funny bits from Elrond during the movie, during the script, but it's almost dichotomous in the way that it matches Brainiac, who every line that Brainiac delivers is menacing and calculating, and you can easily hear the voice of the guy that voiced Brainiac on Superman the Animated Series and in Justice League Unlimited. You can easily hear his voice, or at least I could when I was reading his dialogue. What about you, Nick?
Oh, you say that, but I really didn't remember the Brainiac voice from Justice League Unlimited all that much. I kept hearing, because I've been playing it over the last couple of days as I finished up the script, I kept hearing the voice of the guy who does Brainiac and Injustice 2. But that's just because it's the most recent thing on my mind.
Gotcha. So we set up Brainiac and what his whole deal is. He's looking for a power source, and he and Elrond have some nice little banter back and forth. But Brainiac realizes that an ancient Kryptonian power source, not ancient, but a Kryptonian power source that was designed by Jor-El, because, yes, this movie goes with the more modern take on Brainiac, that he's the reason that Krypton was destroyed. And kind of very similar to the animated take on Brainiac. He caused the destruction of Krypton, or Krypton, if you will, and had Jor-El turned on by the Kryptonian Council, High Council. And anyway, the Eradicator was developed by Jor-El to protect his son, Kal-El. Brainiac sees it as a limitless power source. And so he's seeking this out because he knows if he has this, he'll be unstoppable. He'll have all the power that he needs to survive forever, basically. So that sets up Brainiac. And that brings us down to Earth. I forgot. Brainiac gets intercepts a message from Lex Luthor informing him that there is Kryptonian life on Earth, and thus sets up the whole thing, the whole shebang, Brainiac coming to Earth because of Lex's message. Nick, how did you read Lex in this script?
I read Lex as something closer to the version of – it's kind of like a hybrid of the Lex that we all have always kind of wanted, you know, the Justice League Unlimited / Superman the Animated Series Lex. Kind of a hybrid between he and the Gene Hackman Lex. It felt more sinister to me, but it still had a lot of comedy to it as well. So it was almost like Warner Brothers was trying to have their cake and eat it too in that regard.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Nick, because the characterization of Lex here is very modern. He's the CEO of LexCorp. He's the ruthless businessman. He's a genius inventor in his own right. But all the dialogue I read as Gene Hackman's Lex. Mm-hmm. Very quippy, not very thought out in what he's saying, just saying what's on his mind at a given time. Almost like a Paul Heyman type, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was very – I think for me that was a little odd. I think Lex was the one part that
– How great would Paul Heyman be as Fat Lex?
Oh, he'd be great. He'd be amazing. He would be amazing. But there's a lot of great Lex lines in this. But then right in the midst of a great Lex line, there will be a line from Lex that doesn't sound like Lex to me, or sounds like Hackman Lex, which is fine, but it's just interesting.
I would say that of all the characters in the script, all the characters in the script, there are two where some of Kevin's worst tendencies kind of come into play in terms of overwriting the dialogue at times, and I think those are Lois and Lex. I think both of them too often have too much to say, go on monologues that just go on a little too long, and by their nature have a couple lines in there that kind of feel out of character.
Yeah, so some technical difficulties there. Which two characters were you referring to?
Lois and Lex.
Gotcha, yep. So we get we meet Lex and Brainiac are introduced to one another via this computer message, or at least Brainiac is made aware of Lex's presence and Lex's message about Superman. Then we go to Earth where Lex is on a TV show with Lois.
Yeah, he's on a TV show with Lois, kind of a crosstalk style, Sunday news show of some sort. Folks, we apologize again.
The show consists of Lex bashing Superman, basically, and talking about how Superman can't be trusted, advocating for something called the Wortham Act, which I thought was really clever from Kevin.
Yeah,
Smith.
A nice little nod there.
Frederick Wortham, of course, the gentleman who wanted comic books banned back in the 50s, rather. And the segment ends with Lois physically attacking Lex on the set, which is
somewhat
odd.
Yeah, that was an odd one. I didn't really understand the point of that one, because wouldn't she be clearly charged with assault there? But I suppose that's neither here nor there.
Right. Then we get to what I thought was one of the best parts of the script, the Hobbs Bay scene, Nick, which is also known as Suicide Slum, which is what we all know it as from the comics that were longtime Superman fans. But it's referred to as that in passing on here. You get this awesome scene where, of all characters, Deadshot tries to kidnap the governor's son and hold him hostage, only for us to meet Superman for the first time in this movie. So I don't know about – the whole scene is just set up beautifully with the sound effects, and you kind of see flashes of red, but you don't actually see Superman. And it all builds and builds and builds to the point where when you finally see Superman and he rescues this little the boy and brings him up to the roof of the Daily Planet, and when you first see Superman, it's this perfect Superman moment where in the midst of this firefight, in the midst of all these villains, he takes the time to make sure this boy is comfortable and feels safe, and makes a little joke with the boy, and the kid says, "Hey, my mom thinks you're cute," and Superman goes, "That's why I voted for her," winks, and then leaps in. It. The whole thing is just so Superman, and Superman, of course, ends up confronting Deadshot, a couple of decent Deadshot lines, and we get a great shot of the bullets bouncing off Superman's chest. Brainiac observes all this from on high and realizes that, and he believes actually that Superman is being powered by the Eradicator. So I don't know about you, Nick. I thought this whole bit with Deadshot was awesome.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. You're talking about the Superman stuff. That's one thing I was a little surprised by in the script is, you know, given his penchant for writing, you know, dirty, quippy dialogue that, you know, characters exchange at rapid-fire paces, I was a little worried about how the Superman dialogue would come off in the script. But surprisingly, he kind of nails the earnest farm boy tone of Superman that I've kind of always heard in my head. And so it's odd.
Yep.
It's odd to me to see Kevin Smith writing the character of Superman as well as he does in this one.
Absolutely. I totally agree. This felt like a classic Superman scene, the way it was even – and for a guy that we've both talked about even earlier on this show as not being known for action scenes per se, I thought he really had a good vision for this scene. I was picturing it in my mind, and the action looked good. At least, you know, in my mind it looked good.
But were you playing it on the roof of your apartment?
I was, actually. I formed a little a rectangle with my thumbs and index fingers,
mm-hmm.
and was looking at it through that and projecting it onto my ceiling.
Hmm. Interesting.
Hey, don't knock it till you try it. Then we get our first introduction to real Lex, the Lex that is not trying to portray an image for someone. And he's referring to Lois hitting him and says, "I can't believe the bitch tagged me," which is – that's what I'm talking about. That's a Hackman line, if ever there was one. But, which is fine, you know, but it's just, I don't know, interesting. So, we meet Jimmy briefly. We meet Lois, who references the Joker. So that clearly establishes that Batman and Superman are in the same universe, as gets established again later in the film, and a bit we'll talk about. there's great exchanges here between Lois and Jimmy and Lex. Lex pulls a Nick Duke, puffs on a cigar, and sips brandy.
I do not drink brandy, sir. I'll have you know.
Sometimes you just got to see what develops.
No, I don't drink brandy. It just doesn't. It doesn't happen. I've never done so. And
You've never hung out in robes, drank a gallon of brandy on Thanksgiving.
No, I've never drank a gallon of brandy. I'm not gonna. I can't speak to the other two aspects of that statement that you just uttered, but no to the brandy is what I'm driving.
You've never thought that my style was worth digging.
What does that have to do with brandy?
Well, hang out, drink a gallon of brandy, hang out in robes, and see what develops.
All I'm saying is that maybe I was drinking something other than brandy. That's all I'm driving at, Greg.
Were you drinking from the sweat of Tom Brandy, a.k.a. Salvatore Sincere?
Ho-ho.
Nevertheless. So we meet Lex, and Superman actually confronts him because Superman found the serial number of Lex's company on this weapon that Deadshot was using. So he threatens Lex, and Lex, of course, is in classic Lex fashion, has covered all of his tracks. There's no way Superman can bring him in, and Superman pretends like he's going to hurt him, but he doesn't. He just fakes him out, and Lex gets humiliated, which only pisses him off further. We get what I thought was another really cool, I could see this going one of two ways. It could have been really cheesy or could have been really effective and kind of cool. And I kind of dug it, the Lois and Clark first meeting in the script where Superman shows up and Lois kind of mocks Clark. And I loved how they revealed that it's all a gag and that she actually knew who he is. And it's established in the script that Lois and Clark know each other, love each other, and she knows he's Superman and vice versa. So they've clearly been dating for some time.
Yeah, the only thing that threw me off is the line where she says, "Must we do this every night?" And it sounds like,
yeah,
I was kind of like, true. So do they do this all the time? And if so, why? Like, what is the motivation behind doing this all the time?
It's a bizarre fetish where Clark likes to be made fun of.
Or perhaps Clark just likes to remember the times when he could, you know, X-ray vision Lois with impunity, I suppose.
I suppose so. That was a strange line. I agree with you on that. But no, nevertheless, it was a good scene. It was very effective. I liked their back and forth and, you know, how they still, like, kind of insult each other even though they're in love. So it's just adding to that classic Clark and Lois dynamic that's always been there. And, of course, he punctuates it with a really bad pun. Which is classic Superman as well. Elrond confronting Lex in the bathtub. Definitely a comedic scene here that was designed to add a little bit of levity. And then Brainiac shows up, and he and Lex form a partnership where I'm having trouble remembering, Nick. What is the nature of their partnership? What does each of them – Lex gets to control the power on Earth, correct, or something like that?
Well, what Lex wants is simply Superman to be eliminated. You know, he hates Superman. And so
that's right. Yep.
Brainiac is promising Lex that he will get rid of Superman if Lex can help him, one, locate the Eradicator, and two, come up with a power source for Brainiac while he is on Earth. And so it turns out that Lex has the satellite system in place in outer space, and it's pointed at the sun and able to draw solar energy, and that is part of the deal, is that Lex is going to provide Brainiac with that solar energy to keep him powered while he's on Earth as well.
Yes, and in classic DC film and television fashion, there's a doctor here named Dr. Schuster, course, an homage to one of the co-creators of Superman, and he gets killed, unfortunately, but nevertheless, Clark
Yeah. Nevertheless, Clark does some things, and we apologize. They have a...
Clark does what, Greg?
They have dinner on top of Mount Rushmore.
Yes.
Clark and Lois,
yes.
And so they have this nice exchange, really good dialogue here, I thought. Really introspective dialogue about Clark and doing a great job of humanizing him, which is something that I think whatever revival of Superman they did needed to do is to humanize Clark for a modern era. This does a good job of that. And it culminates with Clark proposing to Lois, and she is unwilling to say yes because she feels that Clark belongs to the world, not to her. And she doesn't want to be the person responsible for coming between Superman and saving the world.
Right. She doesn't want to, you know, and she also says at one point that she would love to have a life with Clark, but she doesn't want a half life. So she also seems to have a little bit of jealousy in there too, at least is how I took it, is that she also kind of wants, you know, all of Clark and not just part of him. And that sounds really dirty. Oh, spank it.
Oh, spank it. Speaking of all spank it, there's a great Eradicator line later in the script, along those lines. But, yeah, so anyway, this is the first time that we start to see Clark be affected because Brainiac has blocked out the sun with this device. It's this, what is this, Shadowmancer, I believe, Nick?
Shadowcaster.
Shadowcaster, not Shadowmancer. That's something totally different. Shadowcaster blocks out the sun. And as a result, Clark, who is powered by the sun, instantly starts to feel like his powers are on the fritz a little bit. So, nevertheless, he goes off, saves some people, does his thing. And that's when Brainiac unleashes Doomsday, which here starts out as a larval cell-type creature and is rocketed down into Earth, starts tearing stuff up. And meanwhile, Clark and Lois and Jimmy are in Perry White's office, and Clark and Lois talk about the previous night and continue having some pretty interesting dialogue about the nature of their relationship and everything. Clark saying, I don't know what I've done that's wrong. And, you know, Lois is kind of pissed at him. And then Clark has to go off and take on this new creature, Doomsday, that has arrived. As Nick mentioned earlier on, this would be really hard to actually film in 1998 because the way it's described sounds amazing and could absolutely be done today, but might have been pushing it on something like an Armageddon budget, you know?
Oh, for sure. I mean, they were talking about like having Superman and Doomsday burst down through the pavement into the sewers and back up through the pavement multiple times throughout the fight. And I just don't see how that effect would have worked in 1997, 1998, let alone how they would have animated the Doomsday creature, or if they would have had to go with, you know, some sort of animatronic or rubber suit, or I don't know, man. I just don't see it personally.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it was the right time for that. It would have been maybe it could be done, but it would be really touchy, and most likely they would have tried to rely on 1998 CGI, which would, you know, would be fine for the time, I guess, but would not look good in hindsight, probably. The one cool little touch I liked here that is not in the comics is Lex trash-talking Superman on a frequency only Superman can hear while Superman's being beaten to death by Doomsday.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. I liked that. Liked that a lot, actually.
So the depower, the kind of, not completely depower, but the weakened Superman, is in a knockdown, drag out fight with Doomsday. It goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Meanwhile, in the Antarctic, we see the Eradicator creature awake. This artificial intelligence, the Eradicator, activates because it senses that Superman is in danger. And And of course, we get the same ending as in the comics. Superman and Doomsday beat each other to death, literally, in the streets. They hit each other so hard, all the windows break. Clark dies in Lois's arms, as in the iconic shot in the comics.
But notably, Doomsday survives.
Yes. Doomsday actually briefly survives this fight. He wakes up. He's unconscious, but he wakes up. And as soon as he wakes up, he gets vaporized by a beam from Brainiac's ship. And that's when Lex institutes his plan. So the Man of Steel has been killed, and Brainiac and Lex announce an alliance. And Lex's story is that Brainiac and Superman were working together to stop Doomsday and a creature and an armada of creatures like Doomsday who are on their way to Earth. And that Brainiac was actually Earth's savior, and that Superman was his herald. Think Silver Surfer to Galactus, if you will. And that Brainiac is here to save the people of Earth with Lex Luthor. And Lex, meanwhile, is going to keep the Earth powered while the sun is blocked out to camouflage Earth from the armada. That sounds ridiculous, but it actually makes sense in the context of the script.
It does. I agree.
So, meanwhile, the Eradicator activates this device that teleports, as Kevin Smith writes, Trek style.
Well, and that's one thing we should probably pause and mention, Greg, is the Eradicator has been talked about, but Superman isn't actually aware of the Eradicator's existence.
Right.
And the Eradicator doesn't actually make an appearance until the moment at which Superman actually dies.
Yes.
Apparently, the Eradicator, it is revealed, is a machine that Jor-El invented basically to ensure Clark's survival no matter what. And so when Clark's vitals drop below a certain level, back at the fortress, the Eradicator kicks on. And it's kind of a cool concept they do with the Eradicator in terms of they reveal that he isn't a separate entity, but he actually is the rocket ship that that Clark flew to Earth in.
Yes, and he teleports Clark to the fortress where there is a regenerative chamber of green goo that he puts him in. And Clark, in the meantime, is going through this dreamlike state where he sees his dad, Jor-El. And Jor-El explains to Clark what the Eradicator is. And this is how the audience actually learns about the Eradicator and learns about Brainiac's true history. This is where we find out that Brainiac destroyed Krypton. This is where we find out that Brainiac betrayed Jor-El and that the Eradicator exists and is there to help Clark. Clark thinks this is all BS or malarkey, or thinks he's seeing, you know, his life flash before his eyes. Wakes up in this room with the Eradicator, and that's when we really get introduced to the Eradicator. And this, again, one of my favorite parts of this script is the Eradicator. I absolutely love what Kevin Smith did with him here. Totally different than the comics, than any version that we've seen in the comics in terms of his personality, if you will. Probably closest to his incarnation around the Reign of the Superman era. But I absolutely loved it. It was funny. He had a great little he builds a great rapport with Clark as he explains why he's there. He tries to talk Clark into leaving Earth and going to find a new planet to live on with the yellow sun, trying to convince him that Brainiac's unbeatable. Clark talks him out of it because Clark, even though when Clark wakes up from his resuscitation,
yeah, so when Clark wakes up from his resuscitation,
and he's resuscitative suit.
Yeah, sorry. So when he wakes up from his resuscitation, what now, Greg?
He has no powers.
Right.
He's completely powerless. He has the black suit that we know from the comics. And Eradicator kind of explains to him the whole deal that's been going on, and this actually freaks Clark out because Clark says, wait a minute, you've been here the whole time in the fortress. And the Eradicator says yes, and Clark says, wait a minute, if you were here,
yeah, Clark says, wait a minute, if you were here in the fortress, that means
there's a beat
That means you saw Lois and I, you know, doing...
Well, you say something about it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man, that's good. Moving on!
Yeah. So, the... another thing that we actually forgot to mention. During, they have the great, you know, the classic funeral for a friend that comes up, where Superman's funeral takes place. And there's what I thought was a not a great big Batman cameo.
Oh, I like the Batman cameo.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess I didn't mind the fact that it happened. Like, the cameo itself is fine. I think I just, it just didn't read like Batman to me. Maybe like Adam West Batman, I guess.
No, I think it was just trying to be a bit more a Batman kind of done through the Superman lens, like a Batman that wasn't going to be, you know, grim and brooding and all that kind of stuff, and a Batman that was trying to deliver a message of hope when, you know, the people of Metropolis, their symbol of hope had been lost. I think Batman is a character who sees the value in that. It's just, you know, can't necessarily be that to people at all times.
It does beg the question, though, where is Batman when the world is engulfed in shadow?
Well, that's a little bit outside of Batman's pay grade. And he makes reference to the fact that he would be there in Metropolis if he could, but that criminals in Gotham have taken the constant cover of night as an opportunity to step up their criminal enterprises, and so he is needed there in Gotham.
Certainly, but one would think that it stands to reason that with no Superman to protect the Earth, that somebody would have to step up to take on what was clearly an alliance between Brainiac and Lex. Batman would know that, certainly.
Well, Batman probably would know that, but again, his first responsibility is to Gotham. And if we're going to get into that logic, Greg, why doesn't Captain America just show up in every Marvel movie to help people out? That's that classic paradox.
That's true. Why doesn't he, Nick?
Because that's not the way movies work, Greg.
How come Superman don't show up in every romantic comedy, too?
I don't...
Why don't every character show up in every movie?
I don't know.
That's the question that we need to ask.
I guess, yes.
Yes? No? Us?
I don't know.
I don't know either. What's going on right now?
I don't know. Let's just move on.
So Batman makes an appearance there, of course, as we mentioned. Brainiac and Lex never really trust each other the whole time. Both of them are already planning to betray one another at the end of all this, unbeknownst to the other. Superman, as we mentioned, has no powers. The Eradicator actually forms himself into a suit that Superman can use because the Eradicator realizes there's no point in trying to reason with him anymore, that he's hell-bent on saving Lois and saving the planet. So Superman gets this – I couldn't get a good picture in my mind of what this suit looked like. Could you, Nick?
No, I think it was supposed to be some sort of metal exoskeleton, almost like a version of the Jim Gordon Batman suit from the comics a couple years ago, or perhaps an Iron Man suit of some sort. Just kind of a metallic suit, because they make reference to the fact that it covers Clark's entire face because nobody can actually recognize who it is underneath the suit. So,
yeah.
Some sort of metal exoskeleton.
And it starts while Clark stops in the midst of his quest for Brainiac to save a burning building. Eradicator fashions this suit that duplicates his former powers, and Superman goes in and saves these people, and it starts to have an effect on the Eradicator. That was, I think, one of the hidden stories in this movie is almost the story of the Eradicator, a machine becoming human, and juxtapose that with Brainiac, who is the ultimate example of a cold and unfeeling machine, even though he's technically an alien being. What did you make of the Eradicator in this overall? What did you make of the Eradicator's journey in the movie?
Yeah, I mean, it was very surprising to me. I mean, you know we discussed a couple months ago during the initial rebirth arc of Superman about how I don't really know that much about the Eradicator. So to see him characterized in this way in a more heroic role was odd to me because I have no prior knowledge of the character, so I wasn't sure if that's something they had really done in the comics or not. And to have him be influenced by Clark's nobility and care for humanity was certainly an interesting take. And like you said, it sets up that interesting comparison to Brainiac. So I kind of thought it was cool, though I found myself wondering, you know, if this was a new invention or if this was something they had pulled from the comics. And from what you're saying, it sounds like mostly a new invention.
Very much, largely, although there are elements that were pulled from the comics. There was a heroic take on Eradicator in Reign of the Superman, once Clark actually comes back, the Eradicator helps him. And if you recall, when Hal and Clark are fighting against Mongol and the cyborg Superman, Eradicator is actually there helping them. And he ends up becoming a hero for a while after that. And he joined the Dark Stars, if you remember them, Nick, who were almost like...
Yeah, vaguely, yeah.
The kind of replacement Green Lanterns of the 90s that... They were like, but they were more rebellious and extreme. So the Eradicator was part of them for a while. And then I don't know what really happened to him. I think at some point they turned him villainous again. But yeah, they're around the time of this movie, he would have been a hero in the comics, although not one that had his own title. And they never really pursued the he's been inspired by Clark's humanity angle, at least to my knowledge, the way that they do in this movie.
Right.
But I liked it. I thought it was really good. Mm-hmm. So Eradicator and Superman go back and confront Brainiac. Meanwhile, Lois and Jimmy are uncovering this whole plot by Lex and Brainiac. And this, again, is one of my favorite parts of this script. I really, really liked how they made Lois and Jimmy important in this movie and made them almost just as important as Superman in the Superman movie, because Lois is really the one that won't quit trying to expose Brainiac and Lex and ends up being the one that unravels the whole thing and causes, at least on Lex's end, the whole thing to come apart and ultimately becomes a thorn in Brainiac's side as well. Really enjoyed this whole subplot. Really enjoyed the scene. There's a great scene with Lois and Jimmy where she's finally letting out her emotions about Clark being dead, and she ends up screwing up and throwing Clark's name in place of Superman, which kind of reveals his identity to Jimmy. And I loved that whole scene. I love this whole subplot. What about you?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Enjoyed it for sure. It was good to see that not every character in Metropolis was essentially stupid, because the implication is that Brainiac and Lex clearly pulled the wool over like 99% of the population's eyes.
Yeah.
And so it was nice to see that somebody wasn't a complete idiot in the town.
Right, yeah, it reminded me of the episode of Family Guy where Lois runs for like school board or something, and she and her opponent keep, no matter what they say, the audience will applaud, and so Lois ends up just saying like catchphrases like 9/11, applause, terrorism, applause, and that's kind of what it reminded me of, because it sounds like Lex just basically says anything and the crowd just goes nuts. And they're maniacs for Brainiac.
Yeah, that was a little hokey in my opinion, but
yeah, I agree.
I got it, I guess.
There were a few moments in the script that came off really hokey, and that was one of them for sure. These T-shirts, I'm a maniac for Brainiac. There were a few other.
Yeah, there were definitely a few moments throughout, like we were saying. Maniac for Brainiac is not awesome. In just a moment, Greg's going to tell you
Fronts
what other moments
Brainiac
he thought
and
were
Lex
a little hokey.
Yeah,
so Greg, the other moments you thought were hokey besides Maniac for Brainiac, we cut out on something there for a moment.
Oh, yeah. No, just little moments here and there. Some lines of dialogue from Lois, some lines of dialogue from Lex that kind of... there's one line in particular, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, but Lex said something at one point that sounded like nothing no human being has ever said. And I actually remarked to myself about that when I read it. I was like, who in the world has ever said that?
Yeah, that's been one of the criticisms of some of Kevin Smith's dialogue at times, that it doesn't actually sound like real human beings. I tend to disagree with that.
Turns on Brainiac.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work very well.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. Lex turns on Brainiac. Brainiac uncovers that. But he ends up keeping Lex around anyway so that Lex can power him. And realizes that Lois is the love of Superman's life. And so he kidnaps Lois and holds her hostage. And after Lois has exposed the plan of the two of them, and Superman and the Eradicator rush to fight Brainiac and his minions, including the Thanagarian Snare Beast, which is just moments away from taking Lois. Meanwhile, the Eradicator flies off with Superman, rips off an S symbol, slaps it on his chest, and the Eradicator sacrifices himself to
destroy the Shadowcaster.
Destroy the Shadowcaster.
Thus,
make these selfless sacrifice, embracing his humanity for once. Repowering Superman with the sun,
mm-hmm.
and thus we get the big save of Superman rescuing Lois from the Thanagarian Snare Beast, defeating said Snare Beast, then defeating Brainiac, and in a moment that would surely rile the Twitter users today, killing Brainiac, seemingly.
Yes, because the idea is that Brainiac is a machine. Superman calls him a machine, and so it feels like he is able to get away with that. You know, I don't count that one. That one doesn't meet my murder test, Greg. I don't know about you.
Yeah, well, I was a little confused about it because Brainiac's a Kaluan, and the line of dialogue as Superman kills him kind of or finishes him, catches me off guard a little bit because he's like, it almost sounds like he's coming up with excuses.
So
to do it.
I don't know much about Brainiac in the comics. Is he actually a Kaluan, or is he something, a machine that was created on the planet Kolu?
It varies. It varies.
Do they ever confirm in this script that he's actually a Kaluan form and not a machine of Kaluan invention?
No, they don't.
Okay.
They do not.
And so that's how I read it.
They refer to him as an artificial intelligence at the beginning who shows up in Krypton. Krypton. And so Superman punches a hole through Brainiac, seemingly finishing him off. Of course, we as comic book fans know better. Goes back and has a great kind of one-upsmanship moment on Lex. Lex is about to escape to Aruba. Superman confronts him in front of the cops and gives him this device that was handed to him by Jimmy earlier of this all this stuff that he and Lois uncovered. So Lex has been disposed of. Brainiac's been disposed of. Superman goes and hangs out with Lois. They have this great exchange, and he realizes he's reached this epiphany over the course of the movie that Lois had it all wrong, that while Superman looks out for everyone, he doesn't do it for the world. He does it for her. Whenever he's in trouble, she's who he thinks of. Whenever he is doing well, she's who he thinks of. So it's this great romantic moment between Lois and Clark, and she basically essentially tells him that she wants to accept his proposal now, and they have a great, awesome moment there to seemingly end the movie. Then we cut up to the skull ship of Brainiac, where Elrond grabs the remains of Brainiac and deposits the remnant into his circuitry, then looks at the camera and says, I know, but I'm a glutton for punishment.
Certainly an interesting closing shot.
Yeah, wasn't really sure what to make of that, Nick. I thought that was probably the thing that felt the most tacked on.
Yeah, it definitely felt tacked on, and I think it was intended to draw really big laughs, and I don't know, it just kind of came across as really silly in a movie that had comedy for sure, but it wasn't a comedy overall, so it felt odd to end it on this little winking funny moment.
Right, and it was unnecessary because, like you said, there were plenty of funny moments in the movie. But yeah, nevertheless, that felt tacked on. Let's before we talk about our overall impression, what worked for you in the movie and what didn't work for you in the movie?
Most of it worked, honestly. I mean, with the exception of the Lex and Brainiac gaining the trust of the public subplot, like I said, I kind of felt like that made a lot of people look like idiots. I didn't really dig that particular aspect. And then there were a few moments here and there in the dialogue, but for the most part, it's kind of hard to find anything that didn't really work. The rest of it, I really enjoyed. I mostly thought that they had a good characterization of Lex, a good characterization of Lois and Clark's relationship. I dug all the character dynamics. So I would say 85-90% of the movie really worked for me. And that, you know, like I said, just the little Lex and Brainiac gaining the public's trust subplot was the only thing that kind of stuck out as a major red flag, in my opinion.
Yeah, I was surprised at how much I liked it. I really did like it overall. I don't think it was, you know, blow away great, but I thought it was good. It was
as good as you could expect a mid-90s superhero script to be, probably.
I think that's fair. Yeah, it was good, and I think the elements that worked the best were Brainiac and the Brainiac Lex alliance. I really liked that. Lois and Clark's relationship was well done. Jimmy Olsen didn't feel like a drag like he can sometimes
on Superman, especially.
Yes, and we're going to get to that a little later, and. Yeah, a lot of the script worked. The action scenes seemed well put together for the most part. There were a few that I don't think ever would have worked, and there are a few that were really confusingly written. But for the most part, well done. The Eradicator was great. I think Lex wasn't really written the way that I would have imagined him to be written, but at the same time, he was Lex, you know? He was a conniver and a schemer, as the Joker would say. And, I liked a lot of this script. There were elements here and there. Like I mentioned, the action sometimes could be a little confusing. The Elrond ending, certainly. A few lines here and there, but nothing major. So overall, I kind of wish this had happened. I mean, I know that it probably would not have turned out well, but I kind of wish this. I wish this would have happened. I would have liked to have seen this script in action because I think it would have done a pretty good job of modernizing Superman at the time.
There have been rumors for a long time about an animated version possibly happening at some point, direct to video. I will say I agree that I wish this script would have been made, but I think you would probably agree with me. There's no way that Tim Burton should have been the guy to make this script.
Agreed.
Like, this is not – I understand completely why this script was thrown out the window whenever Burton came on board, because this is a straightforward superhero movie, and Tim Burton in 1997 had no interest in making such a movie and probably wouldn't have been capable of making such a movie.
And I'm not sure if it was Superman Reborn, the script before this one, or the guy that took over for Kevin Smith and wrote the follow-up treatment for Superman Lives – that had the concept of Lexiac, where Brainiac and Lex become one.
That was in the follow-up script written by Wesley Strick, and that was a concept that Burton pushed for and came up with, and actually
was later used.
Yes, one of the things they would do during the development of the Tim Burton version of this movie is Burton would actually draw a little like hand-drawn images of different things he wanted to see in the movie, and they would storyboard it out and then translate it into the script in terms of how they could use it. And that was one of the concepts that he actually came up with, was Lexiac.
Yeah, which is something we ended up seeing on Justice League Unlimited years later. Right. Dwayne McDuffie's iconic Cadmus arc that he kind of shepherded culminated with the Lexiac thing, which, so, hey, it ended up, you know, working out in the long run. little quick aside, we both recommend this script. If you can find it online, it's an interesting read and certainly a microcosm of the time. There have been a lot of rumors out about the fantasy cast for this movie that Kevin Smith had in mind and that Tim Burton had in mind. We know Nicolas Cage was going to play Superman.
Yes.
We know that. But let's fantasy cast the rest of this thing.
Okay, are we fantasy casting it, or are we talking about the various rumors that were out there at the same time?
Well, we can throw out some of the rumors, and then we can fantasy cast after. The rumor that was most laughable to me is that Kevin Smith allegedly wanted Jason Mewes to play Jimmy Olsen, which
and
I can't see.
See, you told me about that a few days ago, and I had never heard that. It's not mentioned in the documentary, and I've never heard Kevin Smith say that. So it's an interesting bit that you brought up. One of the rumors that Kevin Smith does talk about in the documentary is after he had left the project, apparently Burton and Peters approached Chris Rock to play Jimmy Olsen at one point. So that would have been a very interesting turn of events for sure.
Certainly so. The article that I read online said that Smith wanted Muse as Jimmy and he wanted Linda Fiorentino as Lois.
That makes sense because given at the time they were ramping up to get ready to do Dogma and he kind of was a big fan of Fiorentino, which he no longer is because of personal interactions during the making of Dogma, apparently. So that makes sense. In the documentary, one of the names that Peters throws out and says he felt like they were really close to getting if the movie had moved forward was Sandra Bullock for Lois.
Which I would have loved.
Yeah, I know you would have.
Late 90s Sandra Bullock, sure, why not? Now, I've also heard, and maybe you can clear this up for me, Nick, I also had heard that Kevin Spacey was attached to the project,
yep.
Even back then.
Yes, Kevin Spacey, apparently, and this is covered in the documentary, Kevin Spacey was at one point or another attached to Lex Luthor in every incarnation of the Superman film franchise up until Superman Returns. What I mean by that is, when Superman Reborn was being talked about, Kevin Spacey was on the short list. Superman Lives, Kevin Spacey was on the short list and the leading candidate to play Lex. Superman Flyby, apparently, that J.J. Abrams unproduced script, Kevin Spacey was on the short list. And apparently that was just something that never went away until he wound up doing it in Superman Returns.
Very interesting. So, taking in mind the late 90s, who would you have liked to see in this one?
That's an interesting question. I agree with Kevin Spacey. I mean, I've always said, as much as I despise Superman Returns, I really like Kevin Spacey in that. So it's hard to disagree with that little bit of casting.
Agreed.
It's so hard to remember who was hot at the time in 97 and 98, you know?
Jennifer Aniston, David Schwimmer, Lisa Kudrow.
Oh, the Friends cast. None of the above, please.
Oh, come on. Matthew Perry as Jimmy could work.
Matthew Perry as Jimmy. Matthew Perry as 42-year-old Jimmy Olsen could have worked. Yeah.
It could happen. He just plays him young.
Schwimmer as Brainiac would have been good, just so I could have seen him getting punched a hole through him. That would have been nice.
Come on.
What? I have been.
Your hatred of David Schwimmer is ridiculous.
I have been steadfast in my disdain for David Schwimmer. I'm not a Friends fan. I've never been a fan.
David Schwimmer and Carl. That's your two.
Oh,
and there, Naomi.
There are many more. I was about to say there are many more than just two, but Schwimmer is among them. Although I remember I've also said he was very good in People vs. OJ. So I'm not above giving him some praise whenever he earns it. He just rarely, if ever, earns it.
I'm going to go ahead and say I like the idea of Sandra Bullock as Lois.
Courtney Cox, if you're not to play off the Friends joke too much, but Courtney Cox could have done Lois pretty well.
She could have done it, absolutely, and you can read some of the dialogue. I don't mind that either, Nick. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Kevin Spacey obviously mentioned makes sense. On a serious note for Jimmy, I don't know. I'd have to. Oh gosh. Who's the redheaded actor from CSI Miami?
David Caruso. Why do you want 40-year-old Jimmy Olsen?
I just wanted old Jimmy Olsen playing young. I don't know why. Bob Backlund is Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah, my God. It's just There are a lot of different options. One that was talked about also, I believe, in the documentary, and that never would have worked in the Kevin Smith script,
but would have been really, really interesting in the Tim Burton version of the movie. Chris Walken as Brainiac.
Yes. Yes. Now we're talking. Now we're talking. That's we're talking Walken, and I like that. I like that. That's a great casting choice. I don't mind that one bit. I am going to go one. I'm going to go out on a limb here. Well, not really a limb, because it was going to happen regardless. But I think Nicolas Cage would have been perfectly fine as Superman in 1998.
It's hard to say. I have a difficult time imagining him doing the version of Superman that is in this script that we read.
And you've cut out on.
Yeah, I have a hard time imagining him doing the version of Superman that's in this script that we read, but I think Burton's more loner, quirky take on the character probably would have worked for Cage. I don't know that he could have played the straightforward, earnest version, you know?
Yeah, see, I think he could at the time, because Nicolas Cage in 1998 is a different animal than what we view Nicolas Cage as today. Nicolas Cage had a lot of good movies, a lot of good action roles, and even had a couple of those little earnest, as you put it, roles. Well, you know, the movie he did with Meg Ryan, City of Angels, I think. You know, The Family Man that came a few years later. Well, he wasn't really earnest in that one, but nevertheless. So yeah, that's pretty solid, you know. And hey, if we're talking about earnest, why not Jim Varney as Superman?
Jim Varney as Elrond would have been pretty good casting.
That would have been great. Varney and Walken sharing a screen together. Imagine that.
Elrond's inclusion in the script, by the way, in the Kevin Smith version of the script, was directed by Peters, because Peters wanted a sidekick character for Brainiac, because specifically he had seen Chasing Amy and wanted to use the actor Dwight Ewell, who plays Hooper in that movie, the black militant gay comic book writer, and he wanted to use that guy in the movie as comedic relief. And so apparently Elrond was always supposed to be voiced by Dwight Ewell. Little known character actor of the time.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Which you've nevertheless, you've never seen Chasing Amy, have you?
I have not. So let me rephrase. Not that interesting. For Perry White, I recommend Lane Smith from Lois and Clark to play Perry White in the movie. He's not in it very much, and he's the best Perry White there's ever been.
Let's see. Wasn't it Frank Langella who did it in Superman Returns?
Yes.
That was pretty good. I could get behind that again. Or, let's see. Rip Torn. Let's get Rip Torn as Perry White. How about that?
Rip Torn.
Yeah.
Wow.
Why not?
Well, that's fair. That's fair, I suppose. But yeah, so that was fun. And that was just off the top of our heads. I'm sure there's better choices out there. Let us know, folks. Let us know, have you read the Superman Lives script? If not, from the way we described it, is this a movie that was better off unmade, or is it one that you wish had happened?
Also, let us know, could you understand the podcast, given the frequent interruptions?
Probably not. This is probably going to go down as our worst all-time podcast. But let us know. Tweet us at gphillips8652. Tweet at nickduke87. Join the Facebook Place to Be Nation comics page. Let me be perfectly clear about that. Join the Place to Be Nation comics Facebook page. Type in Place to Be Nation comics. Join. We will add you. We'll have great conversations. Tell us all about Superman Lives from your perspective. Better off on the cutting room floor, or should it have been made? So, with all that being said, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to hit you with an abbreviated version of Reading, Watching, and the Rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back after all. he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
We're back, ladies and gentlemen, with another installment of our weekly look at the news and notes in the comic book world, which we skipped last week. We're back with...
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the
Let's get things started with the television comic book world. We got a litany of announcements here, Nick, and we're just going to bullet point them here for everybody. Black Lightning has gotten a full season order at the CW. Thoughts?
Yay!
Powerless has been canceled by NBC. Thoughts?
Don't give a shit.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has been renewed for Season 5. Thoughts?
I might watch it at some point in the future. And notably, it's also being pushed back to a mid-season debut rather than a fall debut because Inhumans is taking the fall slot. However, it's not a good sign off the bat for Inhumans as that show is debuting on a Friday as opposed to the normal Tuesday slot. And Friday on network television is a tough spot to survive in. Ask shows like Constantine, Hannibal... The list goes on and on.
Nick, ask me what I think about the Inhuman show.
Greg, what do you think about the Inhuman show?
Fuck the Inhumans!
There it is.
Gotham has been renewed for season 4, Nick.
Oh, man, if only there were a certain phrase that two individuals, two pretty decent purveyors of comic book news and notes and, you know, opinions might have come up with a couple years ago in a column. If there was only such a phrase to describe how I feel about the news that Gotham has been renewed for a season 4.
Hmm. How would one write this phrase on Twitter, I wonder?
Oh, I wonder. Huh, let me think about it. I think could they be. Might say, hashtag Gotham sucks. Whew, we were off on that one.
It really, really sucks. It sucks so bad that it got us off.
That's awesome. Wait a minute. They should redo the scene from The Waterboy with Henry Winkler as the offense as the entire offensive line, but instead of seeing Water Sucks, he's singing Gotham Sucks.
Gotham Sucks.
It really, really sucks. That's good.
Why not, ladies and gentlemen? And if it seems like we're going through these quickly, it's because we are. And finally, on the TV front, The Gifted has taken Gotham's time slot. Yay!
Yeah, it's going to be on Mondays, and I might actually watch it. I think Gotham is moving to Thursdays? Question mark? I'm not really sure.
I don't really give a shit.
I don't either. I'm hopeful that it moves to a night where people won't watch it. Why isn't it on Fridays yet?
Gotham will air on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern, while The Gifted will take its place on Monday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, opposite such exciting segments as Stephanie McMahon returning to talk.
Good stuff.
So, The Gifted is the X-Men show, of course, that Fox is doing.
Oh, and in X-Men news, one thing that we skipped over last week because we didn't have a rundown, FXX is going to have a Deadpool animated series coming later this year, and it's going to be written and produced by Donald Glover, who currently has the hit show Atlanta, who is playing young Lando Calrissian in the upcoming Han Solo Star Wars spinoff movie. So Donald Glover got a lot of stuff on his plate right now, and just add the Deadpool animated series to that. No word yet on who's going to play Deadpool, but fingers crossed that maybe Ryan Reynolds would take the time to do it. Apparently it's only like a 13-episode order, so maybe it'll happen. I doubt it, though.
Would be great. I also hope that it's really Deadpool, that it's Unleashed Deadpool. And I'm not really concerned about overexposure because I don't think that there's a lot of characters like Deadpool on TV right now.
Nope.
So bring it on because I'm ready for it.
Absolutely.
Although I don't have FX.
Yeah, Greg doesn't have FXX, so he doesn't get to watch the various shows that are on there. I'll have to find out a way to hook him up with some access through completely legal means.
Of course. Let's move on to the movie universe.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's talk about the DC Extended Universe in the DCEU corner.
Mm.
And we got a couple of items here. Just a couple.
A couple. Few.
There might be a few. Speaking of which, let's talk about the much ballyhooed movie Shazam that we really haven't gotten any development on other than the fact that The Rock.
Now, is it Shazam or is it Shazam with an exclamation point?
I believe it's Shazam.
Interesting. Interesting.
And anyway, The Rock finally mentioned, honestly, this was much to do about nothing. It's not like he said this is who is going to play Shazam. He mentioned the name Armand Hammer.
Army Hammer, you mean?
I'm calling him by his formal name. His York Foundation name, Nick.
Oh, they should get noted New York film critic Armand White to join the York Foundation.
Oh, he'd be perfect.
Yep.
Perfect. So The Rock wants Army Hammer as Shazam. He doesn't really necessarily want him. He says that Army Hammer would be a good choice for Shazam. What are your thoughts on this, Nick?
I think Nathan Fillion would be a great choice for Shazam.
I like Tommy Merlin.
Oh, now we're talking. Now we're talking.
So
no, in all seriousness, it seems like every comic book role now, it's either like Nathan Fillion, Army Hammer. Those are the two names.
That's right.
Rinse and repeat, and they never get any of the roles. So I feel like, why are we even having this discussion at this point?
Army Hammer for Shazam. Yeah, I mean, I actually, I don't have anything against Army Hammer. He was really good in that Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie.
Social Network, he was good in.
But yeah, he was good in both of those. I never saw Social Network, but I've heard he was good in that. And I know he was good in Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Social Network is excellent, Greg. You need to see it. It's Fincher.
He could be a superhero, no problem. But I don't know about Shazam. We'll see. I think that there's still a lot to do on that front. I'd be fine with Stone Cold Steve Austin playing Shazam, quite frankly.
That would be certainly a unique version of Shazam. Not quite the big red cheese that we've all come to know and love.
And I think the movie would culminate with a sing-off between Black Adam and Shazam.
Oh, my.
Solve their problems through the power of song. Anyhow, let's move to the other news. The Flash, the project that, quite frankly, Nick, feels like it is just...
never going to happen?
Yeah, like it's just cursed.
Yes.
The Flash is in the midst of a director search. First of all, the guy that's writing the movie wrote the box office flop known as King Arthur that just came out. Whatever the hell the subtitle was for King Arthur.
Legend of the Sword.
Whatever, yeah.
Who was writing this? I forget.
The guy that wrote that movie.
What's his name, Greg?
Shit if I know. Which is a weird name, admittedly, but...
Oh. All right. Folks, we are the experts here. Who else would you go to for such hard-hitting analysis as this?
Oh, God. Anyway, they got some more bad news this week for the film. Billy Crudup, who has already...
No, that's
been...
not happening. That was debunked already.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Billy Crudup is staying on The Flash. Big pop. Thumbs up, I think.
How about that? I just opened up the story and it's been updated just hours after the original.
Yep. Billy Crudup isn't dropping out of the Flash movie. Is not.
There's your news update.
Yep.
That's very good. Well, nevertheless, they still don't have a director because one of the names that popped up in recent days was Sam Raimi, known, of course, for the Spider-Man films. And The Evil Dead, and he has, and other movies too, I'm sure, by the way, and he has reportedly passed on The Flash, so he will not be directing it. Other directors rumored to be on the short list are Matthew Vaughn and Robert Zemeckis. Vaughn, of course, known for Kick-Ass, known for The Kingsman, known for X-Men First Class. Robert Zemeckis, known for what, Big? Back to the Future, I think. A number of great movies over the years. So, are either of these guys going to get the job? No one knows because there are holdups. Zemeckis is currently working on a project with Steve Carell, and Vaughn is currently kicking around a Kingsman threequel that may jeopardize the project for him. Do you have a favorite in this search, Nick?
Yeah, as I said on the on one of the comics groups that we participated in, I kind of prefer Zemeckis, and I can't really give sound reasoning why. I just remember the general tone of Back to the Future and the time travel elements,
yeah.
And I kind of Back to the Future's tone is kind of what I'm looking for in a Flash movie. It's
agreed. Yeah,
mostly family friendly, but it's still got a little bit of edgy humor in it at points. Not quite as Boy Scoutish as perhaps a Superman project would need to be.
And doesn't take itself seriously.
And doesn't take itself too seriously. So I just, granted, I know he hasn't done a lot of major work in recent years, but I kind of like that idea the more I think about it.
I can definitely see that. I think I'm leaning towards Vaughn because his visual style to me fits so well after having seen Kingsman. Like his panache for action scenes is really good.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I want – he's been linked to a lot of DC projects. I want him to do a DC movie. I just don't know that I want him to do Flash.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I think
why doesn't he do Green Lantern?
Well, why not? Why doesn't Zemeckis do Green Lantern for that matter? Why doesn't anyone do a Green Lantern movie for God's sake and give us some announcements about it?
A good Green Lantern movie, though.
That's true. We don't want it to be rushed. We don't want UA Bulls Green Lantern.
Uwe is his name. I'll have you know.
What the? I don't care how he pronounces it.
That's how it's pronounced, Greg. That is his name.
Special effect for the movie. former Jets center Nick Mangold has mentioned that Daphne Keene.
Whoa, where are we? We're jumping around.
No, yeah, we're jumping around to the next news item, which comes out of the DCEU corner and into the Fox movie corner. And it's not Nick Mangold, it's James Mangold, the director of Logan and the Wolverine, revealed that there have been talks, and he has even brought it up, to bring Daphne Keene back to the Fox film franchise X-23. And no word if it's actually going to happen or how it would happen, given that Daphne Keene's Laura is in the future of the current X-Men universe, and I've gone cross-eyed. But nevertheless, I think this is really exciting. She needs to come back. We obviously need to see more of X-23, and I think there's potential that from the way he talks about it and how excited he sounds, that Mangold might be willing to come back and direct an X-23 movie or a movie about X-23's group of young mutants that we saw at the end of Logan.
Yeah, that would certainly be interesting. As I've said all along, though, the only question for me becomes, if that's the case, how do you make an R-rated film about a group of teenagers, you know? Difficult to sell that one, because theoretically teenagers would be your major audience, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Not saying it's impossible. I'm curious to see how the marketing behind that one would go.
And let's be honest, if there's a studio that's going to do this, it's Fox and not WB or Marvel.
Well, right, because it's worked to this point. They've reaped the financial reward, so I think they're willing to try it as long as it keeps working. So yeah, I mean, definitely could happen. At Fox, but like you, I'm excited to see her come back, and I want to see more of this character. I think keep her going while the momentum is there.
Agreed. Well, to wrap things up, we've got probably, I'd say, the biggest news in the last week, Nick, which is Geoff Johns has come out of the shadows, and he dropped a killer interview with the Sci-Fi last week, and really shook up the comic book landscape. Announcing that his DC Comics and Watchmen crossover story.
Yeah, that story is going to be titled Doomsday Clock. He is working on it with longtime collaborator Gary.
To be
Gary.
Called Doomsday.
Yes, Doomsday Clock. And he's working on it with longtime collaborator Gary Frank. And not only that, it's coming a lot sooner than I think a lot of us expected, as it is set to begin in November of this year.
That's correct. And the interview with Geoff Johns was just mind-boggling, dropping some what I thought were some bombs.
Some hurting bombs, if you will.
Danny D and the whole Dark Knights Metal type event that's coming up. He says there will be no watered-down one-shots or miniseries out of this. It's going to be standalone. It's going to be its own self-contained event. It's going to be between 6 and 13 issues. He hasn't decided exactly how many yet. And it's going to be Gary Frank and Geoff Johns pouring their heart and soul into this story, really focusing on this dichotomy of Dr. Manhattan, who is a human who's lost touch with humanity, against Superman, who is an alien who is arguably more human than any of the humans on Earth. So it's this weird dichotomy between these two characters, and I just can't wait for this event, Nick. The way that John's described it, guys, we can't really explain this interview. You need to read this interview, and much like his Rebirth interview of last year, it's a must read, and how John's just kind of lays out his vision for this story, why he wrote this story, why he wanted Gary Frank, and why Superman and Dr. Manhattan are the perfect characters to see this story play out.
Yeah, tons of great lines in it that are, you know, like Greg said, not just some hurting bombs on DC, but probably some little nods at Marvel as well, just kind of tweaking the entire comics industry. It kind of cool that Geoff has kind of removed himself from the day-to-day operations of comics at this point, and so I think it liberates him a little bit to speak out about his viewpoints on the industry, which by and large, are viewpoints that Greg and I find ourselves agreeing with 9 times out of 10.
Yeah, and he also mentions that the real-life presidential election played a big factor in his decision to write this story, not going after the low-hanging fruit necessarily, but going after the rise of extremism.
Oh boy, I wonder what the keep your politics out of my comics crowd will have to say about that.
Very interesting. Yeah, that's going to be unique. But he does say that he's not going after the low hanging fruit. So I think that it's probably going to be a little more subtle for the probably a little too subtle for those people to understand. So
let's hope.
But yeah, it looks like it's going to be awesome. Can't wait for this. Any theories, Nick? I know we've seen, as we do every time a story like this comes up, we've already seen some Superboy Prime talk, but dare we even speculate on that?
Theories as to what, Greg?
What it's going to be, what the story is going to, what the premise is going to be.
I think it's pretty much going to be Superman versus Dr. Manhattan, locked in some sort of big time struggle. And, you know, as powerful as Superman is, I have a hard time seeing him challenging Dr. Manhattan physically. So I think there's going to have to be some sort of
philosophical
debate and some sort of angle where Superman has got to come up with some sort of strategy for taking down Manhattan, because he finds himself outgunned for once, you know, possibly in his superheroic career.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be interesting to see if there's any of John Osterman left in Dr. Manhattan.
Right.
Story. So.
And that's one interesting aspect of it. How much we know that this version of Superman is one that has lost some time or whatever, but how much time has passed for this version of Manhattan between the events of Watchmen and now? Now, I understand that he you know, his perception of time is that all time is simultaneous, but it was established in Watchmen that he grew increasingly isolated from humanity, you know, as time passed after his accident or whatever. And so more time since the events of Watchmen would only lend him to be further down that road, I would think. So I'm interested in terms of how he perceives the time that's passed between Watchmen and this event.
Yes, as am I. So should be a great event. But with that being said, that brings an end mercifully to the rundown, and we are going to move on to everybody's favorite segment, your favorite segment and mine. You got it.
How about it?
And we had another rousing week of CW shows last week. Of varying degrees of import. Monday night, we had a new episode of Supergirl, in which it was very much focused on our favorite character, I think, Nick, James Olsen.
Good Lord. Good Lord. At a time in the season where all the CW shows should be barreling at full speed towards their conclusions and building momentum, for some reason, Supergirl saw fit to give us a big-time pause and give us a James Olsen-centric episode. And good Lord, was all the James Olsen stuff painfully boring.
How many times are we going to have to watch James Olsen whine and complain about not being important enough?
Hopefully they will ship him off to Siberia or something in the season finale, because he is just unbearable at this point. Absolutely unbearable. Like, he was the one who was convinced he needed to become Guardian because he needed to make a difference.
Yep.
And now he doesn't like the difference that he's making, and so he just whines about it the entire time. And it's just, I did not like this episode very much at all, to be honest.
No, the only parts of the episode I found myself liking were the parts with Lena and Rhea, Terry Hatcher's character. I thought those were good, and I enjoy – I mean, Terry Hatcher's just awesome. She's killing it as Rhea. And Lena is got this great early 2000s Stephanie McMahon thing going on. Big fan. But and also the character's not bad. So, yeah, big fan of
what exactly?
Those, Terry Hatcher and the lady playing Lena Luthor. I enjoyed their scenes together and would like to see more.
Fair enough.
But I, as a whole, no, the episode, I mean, I have no interest in James Olsen's hypocritical, whiny character that needs to just go off and die now. And I of course, do like Mon-El and Kara and all that stuff. Kara hardly in this episode at all, which I thought was
weird. Which is so weird, given the fact that we should be really setting up for the season finale. It's just a weird episode, in my opinion.
Very strange. Didn't like it that much. I agree with you. Tuesday gave us a new episode of The Flash. And tell the folks what happened on that episode.
Greg is making me tell you because he doesn't remember. Because Greg has already watched the episode of The Flash that's aired. And so he is counting – that's aired this week. So he's counting on me to tell you what happened last week.
I'm hearing a lot of assumptions in there. I have not said any of this. This is just – this is one man going off script.
They are assumptions, but are – okay.
Into business
now
for
let
himself.
Me ask you this. Are they false assumptions? Are you debating the veracity of the assumption?
Are you going into business for yourself? Is
no, don't answer my question with another question, Greg. Answer the question. Are you debating the veracity of the assumption?
Not for me to say.
That's what I thought. In any event, last week's episode of The Flash was an episode of The Flash that was about certain things that I'm having trouble remembering at the moment.
Okay, it was about it picked up Savitar explaining to
yes,
Barry.
Yes, okay, there we go. Gotcha. Yep.
Yeah. That he is a time remnant.
Yes.
And so we get the explanation that Savitar in the future is one of the time remnants that future Barry created to defeat Savitar.
Yes.
What does it all mean?
Okay, Battle? So what they're saying is Barry in the future is attempting to stop Savitar, and so he creates a bunch of time remnants of himself so he can have, like, 15 Flashes or whatever fighting Savitar at one time. In this process, Savitar kills all of the time remnants except one. And then Barry traps Savitar in the Speed Force, and Barry and this time remnant Barry are left behind, you know, victorious or whatever. And this time remnant Barry is forced to, you know, to kind of create a life for itself there alongside future Barry. And what happens, we're told, is that Team Flash and real Barry wind up kind of rejecting the time remnant and say, oh, well, that's not really the real Barry Allen, so we can't really accept him fully. And he's kind of forced to live this life of isolation, and it winds up driving him crazy and spurring him to travel back in time to gain powers and become Savitar. And so, because, and they say at one point in the episode, it's a closed loop. There is no which came first. There's no chicken or egg in the scenario. The time remnant was always Savitar, and Savitar was always the time remnant, and you can't really break that loop. And so, time remnant Barry, as Savitar, is seeking to set in motion the events that would force Barry to create time remnants in order to preserve his own existence, and now I've gone cross-eyed.
Good Lord. Nevertheless, with all that stuff out of the way, they get into what's actually a great episode, because they realize that future time remnant Barry has all of regular Barry's memories, so that if regular Barry doesn't have any memories, future Barry will not be able to know what's happening next. So they wipe Barry's mind, inadvertently causing him to have amnesia. And, it works. Savitar can't remember anything either. But Barry now doesn't even know that he's Barry or who anyone else is. And it sets up for one of the more enjoyable episodes of the season, in my opinion. I really enjoyed this one because I'll tell you why, Nick. It was great to see Barry Allen get to be funny again. I liked it in the musical episode for that reason. And I loved it here because Grant Gustin is so funny and so charming as Barry Allen when he gets a chance to be. And understandably, Barry has been down in the dumps for about two seasons now. But it's so great to see him happy and having fun and telling jokes, and being, not telling jokes, but just being funny again. I thought he was great here.
Yeah, I would agree. A little odd to have such a comedic episode in the middle of such dire circumstances. But one might argue that it was a welcome reprieve from the oppressive tone that the season has taken lately.
Yes, I definitely thought so. I thought Barry was awesome here. His interactions with the other cast members, particularly when he asks Wally how they know each other, and Wally tells him, "Hey, you're my brother." And then Barry looks at his hand and looks at Wally and then looks back at his hand again. good stuff. Also, HR met his soulmate in this episode. Oh. Or not met his soulmate, but continued to woo his soulmate.
Yes, HR is putting the moves on. And old Tracy Brand, she is smelling what HR is cooking.
That's right. And quite frankly, so was I. I mean, dude's got game.
He does. He does. We're going to find out what those drumsticks are really used for.
Oh, outstanding. So overall, Nick, your thoughts on the episode?
I really enjoyed it. The Savitar explanation, convoluted as it may be, worked for me. and I will say, you know, we're not talking about the following week's episode yet, but they kind of flesh it out more in the following week's episode of what the explanation is. And I wound up, I'm enjoying it. It's believable to me, and I dig it.
Ooh, yeah, dig it. Yeah, I got to admit, the explanation in that episode did not do it for me, but I do like how they fleshed it out a little bit since then. But that's a story for next week's hopefully more understandable episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Indeed.
So that brings us to last week's episode of Arrow titled Underneath. And or is it titled Underneath? I don't think it was. I think it was titled Honor Thy Fathers. That's what it was titled, yes. So this centered around Adrian Chase, Prometheus, bringing up yet another piece of Oliver's past that Oliver didn't know about or was unwilling to acknowledge. And that is the fact that Oliver's father actually murdered a man.
Mm-hmm.
And this is information that shakes Oliver to his core, shakes Thea to her core. Thea returns in this episode, by the way. Enjoyed seeing her back again. We also see the return of Cody Rhodes as Samson. And thought he did a good job again, enjoyed his little interactions with the various characters over the course of the show. We also, shockingly, Oliver takes down Adrian Chase, Prometheus, seemingly takes mm-hmm. him down with some information about Chase's dad, that Chase's dad was getting ready to disown him before he was killed. Chase asks Oliver to kill him. Oliver doesn't. Oliver and Thea kind of, as best they can, come to grips with what Robert did those years ago. And there's a great, great scene with Ollie and Thea where Ollie kind of has an awesome line about, you know, something to the effect of, you know, our parents were not perfect, you know, but I still love them. Even despite how horrible things that they've done, they're still our parents, you know? And I think a lot of us can relate to, on both sides of that, the idea of sometimes the ones closest to us do things we don't agree with, but it doesn't change how we feel about them. So, really good stuff. I thought the flashbacks were good as well to Leon Yu with Anatoly, who is just a delight every time we see him. Another very enjoyable episode, I thought.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. very interested to see what Prometheus is, what part of his plan is coming up next, because it certainly would seem like he wanted to be caught and still has Oliver right where he wants him. So I can't wait to see next week's episode.
Did you think for a minute that at any point did you actually think that he had been captured, that it was that easy?
Well, no, just because I knew there were two episodes left. So it's one of those, kind of like in wrestling, you know, when the main event is starting like 5 minutes before the show is supposed to go off the air, so you know something screwy is going to happen. One of those kind of things.
Yep. Yep. NWO run-in, baby.
Yep.
So, all right, rank them.
Flash, Arrow, Supergirl.
Same. Agreed. Same rankings for me. So, I have one last thing to add on to watching. I watched the Batman and Bill documentary on Hulu.
Ah.
Or Hulu. This is available now, and it is spectacular. I was thoroughly entertained the entire time. It is really well put together. It is infuriating at times. It is haunting at times. It's just an excellent, excellent documentary. Great comments on there from the likes of Jerry Robinson, Carmine Infantino, Dick Giordano, I should say. Great, great stuff in this documentary. Roy Thomas has some great comments in there. A lot of interesting perspectives. The story of Bill Finger's life is just fascinating, and his son and his granddaughter that no one knew existed. Just all kinds of ups and downs and ebbs and flows, and it'll piss you off to your core when you hear about Bob Kane and some of the stuff that he did. But I can't recommend it enough. Go, if you have Hulu or access to it, check out this documentary, folks. You will enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching it at some point as well. I have been playing Injustice 2, which was released this week for PlayStation 4. I've been playing that. Awesome. I don't want to get too in-depth into it just because we're running a little long this time, but I'll have more thoughts as we go further into it. But a very worthy successor to the first game. Got some awesome characters, some awesome moves, and it continues to be, in my opinion, one of the more accessible fighting games for piss-poor players like Greg and myself.
Yes. Let's move on to Reedon. I got nothing. So
he's got nothing again, so I'll be taking over. So kicking it off with my bottom book of the week, and I've got a free Comic Book Day issue that I was able to fit in. One of the free books that I picked up a couple weeks ago that I'm slowly working my way through, and I'm going with The Legend of Zelda manga, Twilight Princess / Ocarina of Time. Two little snippets of respective mangas in here. This is my bottom book of the week because, one, it's black and white. Two, the art isn't that great. And three, mangas are really difficult to read. So while I appreciate The Legend of Zelda subject material, manga's not my favorite thing in the world. So I'm going with that as my bottom book of the week. Moving on to Anyway, moving on to my number three book of the week, I've got Detective Comics 956. This continues and brings to a conclusion the League of Shadows storyline. And it features the big climactic showdown between Lady Shiva and Cassandra Cain. And it's an emotional issue that's very well done. The other members of the team continue to great moments to shine. And we get the ultimate reveal of what exactly the nature of the League of Shadows is. And, a pretty cool moment between Batman and Ra's al Ghul in here as well. So you just get really cool character moment after really cool character moment. Continues to show why Detective Comics, although it's gotten some competition from All-Star Batman in recent months, is still the best bat book on the stands, in my opinion.
And no ruminating on the nature of fear.
No ruminating on the nature of fear. That's true. Moving on to my number two book of the week, I've got Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 20. This continues the Prism of Time storyline. And this is just great Green Lantern comics. I mean, I really can't say much more than that. It's just every character in the Corps feels like they're getting a moment to shine. Even Guy Gardner and Arkillo get like really cool fist-pumping moments. It's almost like they're being booked, Greg, like the Sheamus and Cesaro of the Green Lantern Corps, where they hated each other at first, but they found a mutual admiration and respect for one another. And I am really excited to see what that pairing of Gardner and Arkillo is going to be like in the months to come. But this is a really great story and makes a lot of sense in terms of the plot and what the villain is seeking to accomplish here. So love the hell out of this one. And then finally, my number one book of the week, I'm going with Star Wars: The Screaming Citadel. This is the one-shot that kicks off the five-part crossover between the Star Wars and Dr. Aphra series. This book is just outstanding Star Wars stuff. I mean, it is, it's almost like a take on a horror comic in the Star Wars universe. So it has this great, like, ominous feel pretty much from about the 5 or 6 page mark going forward. And the main reason it finds myself at number one is Kieran Gillen writes the dynamic between Luke Skywalker and Dr. Aphra so well. I want to see these two characters interacting more, and I absolutely love pretty much every exchange they have in this book, including a little, what seems to be a little bit of some sort of tension between the two characters that I don't know where it's going, because the implication of this point in the book has been that Dr. Aphra is gay, but it certainly seems like there's some sort of romantic interest between the two at this point, which would be amazing in my opinion. And then moving on to my quick hits very quickly, All-Star Batman number 10 kicks off the first ally storyline. It's great, it's fantastic, and it seems to be very Alfred-focused, so I'm excited. Wonder Woman 22, the new artist Andolfo comes on for this one in the latest installment of the Godwatch storyline. Still well-written, but I will agree with some of the criticism I've seen online. The art is a little strange, and it gives me some pause in terms of the issues that are coming up after Rucka's departure, because apparently this artist is going to be staying on for the next little while. The Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows number 7 just continues to be a really great alternate universe look at how this Spider family interacts with the X-Men, and I'm digging the hell out of it. Action Comics 979, first part of the Revenge storyline, is very well done, even though if I don't know who the hell this blank character is. I don't know what the hell this villain is or what his deal is, but
he was the main villain in the Lois and Clark miniseries.
Ah, gotcha. See, I didn't know that, but I dig all the other villains, including the return of the classic cyborg Superman. Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number 10 concludes the Blackbird storyline. Very well done, and we get to see a good little team up between the birds and their respective love interest at various points, as both Nightwing and Green Arrow make guest appearances here, which is a cool dynamic to see those five characters interacting. And then finally, Old Man Logan 23, we continue to approach the end of the Jeff Lemire run. I am sad to see it go, and I think we only have one more big issue left, and going to be looking forward to that one next month.
Awesome. Well, with all that said, folks, that brings an end to this edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We hope you enjoyed the rundown and reading and watching and what you could hear of our script review. If you have any other suggestions for us to go off the page with, let us know. I know one idea I have kicking around that I haven't actually run by Nick is at some point I would like to review that Superman flyby script by J.J. Abrams to see how it compares to the unpublished Kevin Smith script. Then maybe from there, one day we can look at that Superman Reborn script and compare the three and see which one was the best of the unproduced Superman screenplays. So perhaps we'll get around to that eventually. But nevertheless, let us know what you thought about it. And until then, what do we have coming next week, Nick?
Next week is going to be a special edition of the show as we're expanding reading and watching to be half the, or specifically watching to be half the show, as next week we are going to be covering the last two episodes of each of the respective CW shows right up through the season finale. So it's a big CW season ending special edition episode next week. And then the following week we kick off Wonder Woman month that will have, I believe the plan is, a review of the first volume of the New 52 Wonder Woman written by Brian Azzarello. So that is coming down the pike for you here pretty soon.
Excellent. And until then, as you know, we are always here for your feedback. Let us know what you want on the show, and we will comply. In the meantime, have a good one, folks.